This is As It Happens, heard Monday through Friday on CBC Radio 1. Our talk back number is 416-205-3331. Our email address is aih@cbc.ca. Don't forget that you can download our daily podcast and our weekly podcast, too, at our website. That is cbc.ca/aih. There are perks to being a bird, mainly the flying part. But while birds are effortless masters of the air, their high-flown skills do not necessarily translate to the ground. And if they did, there's a good chance that birds would not settle in a ruined place like Chernobyl. Nonetheless, birds have made a home there. And since the turn of this century, Dr. Tim Musso of the University of South Carolina has been studying the ecology of the Chernobyl region. In a study published last week, Dr. Musso revealed something rather surprising about two bird species living within 3 kilometers of the site of the worst nuclear accident in history. It seems that these two species are somehow selecting their nests in the least radioactive areas possible. We reached Dr. Musso in Columbia, South Carolina.
Dr. Musso, I guess your research gives a whole new sense to the idea of a canary in the coal mine when you look at birds in Chernobyl. Tell me about this study.
Yeah, my colleagues and I, in particular Anders Mahler at the University of Paris, and I have been studying birds in and around the Chernobyl area since 2000. And what we've found is that there are many of these species of birds that show particularly high sensitivities to even relatively low contamination levels. The most recent study, which was just published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society, focused on two species of birds that nest in boxes, man-made boxes, the great tit and the pied flycatcher. And a few years ago, using some funds from the National Geographic Society, we put up about 400 nest boxes in and around the Chernobyl area to see how the birds were doing in response to the contamination that they experienced while there.
Did they go for those nests, or what happened?
Well, you know, it was very surprising to us, but what we found is that both of these two species, which are, you know, relatively common in that part of the world, avoided the nest boxes that showed the highest levels of contamination.
Is there any possibility there was another reason for that? Was it coincidentally in the same area, or what?
Yeah, we actually attempted to look at all possible explanations, including, you know, differences in food levels, differences in plants and vegetation in that area, differences in water levels, differences in the age of the birds. We looked at all of these different potentially confounding effects, and really the only thing that's consistent with our observations is that somehow the birds are feeling the higher levels of contamination in some way, experiencing it as either you know, depressed metabolism or some sort of physiological effect, and this is causing them to abandon or avoid the nest boxes that are most contaminated. One of the nice things about this particular study is that because of the way that the radioactive fallout landed, it's very patchy. There are little patches of highly contaminated areas interspersed with areas that are relatively clean, and we have nest boxes interspersed all throughout this patchwork, and so we can actually eliminate and control for many of the other known causes for variation in recruitment to these nest boxes.
Do you have any idea how the birds could be determining it? I mean, is it perhaps a general feeling of malaise? Would they just feel ill when they are near it? Or what's your theory?
We really, you know, can't say for sure, but based on the different patterns that we see in these two species of birds, the pied flycatcher and the great tit, we find that the pied flycatcher shows the strongest avoidance, whereas the great tit is much more weakly avoiding these higher contaminated areas. And we think this has to do with the differences in life histories. The pied flycatcher is a long-distance migrant. It flies to Ukraine from Africa every spring. And when it arrives on the breeding grounds, it's already pretty stressed from this very long-distance migration. think that they're particularly sensitive to any sort of contaminant in the environment. And so they're actually just, they're just not feeling well living in that kind of contaminated area.
Hey, now, given that they're that sensitive and their resources are so depleted when they arrive, why would they settle in the Chernobyl area at all? Surely it's there must be problems for all animal species there.
Well, you know, it's one of the ironies of radioactive contamination is that, you know, you can't see it, you can't smell it, you can't taste it. And so, in fact, if you're an untrained observer without a Geiger counter, you really wouldn't necessarily know that this was a highly contaminated area. It, you know, to the untrained eye, it looks relatively normal. And we're presuming that to the birds, it looks relatively normal. It's not until they actually spend some time in that environment that the consequences are felt.
And how much wildlife is actually returning to that area?
So, yeah, this is one of the issues that comes up repeatedly. Because the people have all left, you know, they've put a big fence around this, luckily, and because the people have gone, there are a number of species that actually have increased in numbers in that area through immigration from adjacent areas that are uncontaminated. But to our knowledge, there have been no empirical studies showing that these animals wouldn't be doing much better in the absence of radioactive contamination. Mm-hmm.
You'd think. I mean, and the fact that they're coming back at all is only because, to Chernobyl, is only because there's no people there.
It's an empty space right now. And so, you know, there have been many anecdotal reports in the media, for instance, that, hey, you know, look at Chernobyl. There are moose in the streets, and there are rare birds that have reappeared that we haven't seen in decades. And really, those don't get to the, you know, the real root of the problem, and that is, how are they doing when they do return? And the only studies that have rigorously investigated that question are some of the work that Anders Møller and I have been doing with these birds and some other species recently. And every rock we turn over, we find evidence that there are negative consequences. Now, you know, another irony is that the negative consequences of radioactive contamination aren't as great as the negative consequences of human habitation in general. But that doesn't mean to say that there aren't, you know, strong effects of these contaminants.
And what kind of negative consequences have you seen?
Well, in we've done most of our work with the barn swallow. And what we found with the barn swallow is that because barn swallows come back to the same place to nest year after year, we can actually put little tags on their legs and we can track their annual survival. And what we found is that barn swallows living in the Chernobyl region have a dramatically lower probability of surviving from 1 year to the next. Their mortality rates are much higher than they are in the control areas. We've also found that the clutch size and the rate at which the eggs hatch is also significantly depressed.
Now, you described this Chernobyl area as being where there's no people, they fenced it off, no one's going there. How are you and Dr. Møller doing?
You know, in the most contaminated areas, we do protect ourselves with protective clothing, and we throw away our clothes after we're done with the field season. Most of the contamination is cesium-137, which is water-soluble, and it is purged from your system relatively quickly. I think it's primarily a danger for those who are experiencing this contamination year after year after year.
Dr. Mousseau, it's good to talk to you.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Dr. Tim Mousseau is a biology professor at the University of South Carolina.